There's a PowerPoint here, but I can't seem to make it go up there. Somebody will do that for me. That's all right. The first slide of the PowerPoint is just the title, so we can charge on without that. Look, I want to say at the outset that I've really little experience in matters relating to international law. Generally, I'd describe myself as a property lawyer who works mainly in the field of native title. And in brief discussion with David beforehand, I mentioned that I really didn't know a lot about international law, and so I was slightly surprised to get the tap on the shoulder for this. And he suggested to me that really that it was part of a plot, I think, to encourage a policy debate about implementation of the Declaration. I suspect there's actually a deeper plot, which is that David was keen to get me, to force me to read through the Declaration in detail. Well, at least in that deeper plot, he's achieved his purpose, because I have now read through the Declaration in detail. But to a certain extent, perhaps that goes to the point that Melissa and David were making. As David said, I have worked in Indigenous affairs, particularly land rights, for a couple of decades now. And of course I was aware of the Declaration, but has the Declaration actually sunk in to the practice of Indigenous land rights, to the work, the day-to-day work of native title practitioners, be they for the state or for the rec bodies? Generally not. And so perhaps that's really the purpose of today, and to a certain extent then the purpose is achieved, at least in one little way, that one native title practitioner has turned their mind in greater detail to the Declaration. Despite this lack of expertise, what I endeavoured to do was to follow the brief I was given for this presentation. And the brief I was given was simply the title, and that was it. And the title I was given was The Declaration in Implementing Indigenous Land Justice. Given that fairly broad-ranging brief, I felt at liberty basically to trawl through the Declaration from, as I say, the perspective of a domestic lawyer who spends most of their time working with the Native Title Act, and identifying as best I could areas within the Declaration that caught my attention when it came to the operation of the Native Title Act. I then briefly researched, well, when I say researched, that was as much as a mediocre internet connection at home earlier this week would allow me to do, briefly researched some of the commentary on the matters that struck me as interesting in the Declaration from the point of view of a practitioner. So what follows is the results of that process. Now, the results of that process were really, there were four areas in the Declaration that caught my attention, and they're the ones I've got up there. The Future Acts issue, the notion of cultural revitalisation, some of the practicalities of Indigenous governance, and the, for a land rights practitioner, the key areas, which are probably Articles 26 to 28, and actually turning to sort of, in some detail, to implementation of those. To a large extent, the discussion under each of those topics is discrete, and so I'll not attempt to sort of summarise them by way of introduction, but just get on and do it. Well, to look first, and there we've got the whole text of it, which is Article 32.2. I won't read it out, but the emphasis I want to bring to that is what I've emboldened and particularly underlined there. This is the notion of free, informed and prior consent, or consent prior to the approval of projects affecting their lands. It's generally seen as one of the sort of key elements of the Declaration, this notion of free, prior and informed consent. And so you'll find through the Declaration there are a number of other articles that use this construction, free, prior and informed consent, Articles 10, 11, 19, 28, 29. And so on. It's a key concept. Now, what does it mean? Well, the best commentary I could find on it domestically was the ATSI Social Justice Commissioner's Native Title Report 2010. And there the Commissioner is suggesting, oh, there you go, I've jumped ahead. The free should imply no coercion, intimidation or manipulation. The prior should imply that consent has been sought sufficiently in advance of any authorisation or commencement of activities and that respect is shown for the time requirements of Indigenous consultation. Inform, the Commissioner suggests, should imply that information is provided that covers at least the following aspects: nature size, pace, reversibility and scope of the project, reason for or purpose of the project, duration, the locality of the areas that will be affected, a preliminary assessment of likely economic, social and cultural environmental impact, the personnel likely to be involved, the procedures that the project may entail, the consent, the Commissioner goes on to suggest, should involve consultation and participation as crucial elements. Consultation should be undertaken in good faith. The parties should establish a dialogue allowing them to find appropriate solutions in an atmosphere of respect and good faith. And the description of the consent requirement continues, but I won't. The Commissioner in that same extract goes on to suggest Indigenous people should specify which representative institutions are entitled to express consent on behalf of the affected peoples or communities. I mention that particularly because it comes to one of the other points I'm going to get to, which is the practicalities of Indigenous self-government. Well, what then of the Future Act requirements in Part 2, Division 3 of the Native Title Act? Now, when I've been teaching Native Title Law, and I've done that a bit, the Future Act regime of the Native Title Act has been virtually guaranteed to terrify students. And a particular piece of that, and an excellent teaching item for those of you that might be teaching it, is what's called the simplified flowchart of the right to negotiate process. And I was looking for one, I didn't have it handed, but those of you that have seen, so it was put out by the National Native Title Tribunal, and I think it's often replicated in the volumes of the Native Title Act you get. Well, it looks like some bizarre, intricate Celtic maze design, and tends to convince students that they'd really prefer to work in tax or mergers and acquisitions. But when you cut through it, the Future Act regime procedures can be fairly simply summarised as follows. And there are three key types. And look, there's a lot of detail in this that I'm just cutting through, but to get to the core notions. There are those procedures that require no engagement with native title holders at all. And two examples of that are the subdivision F procedures that indicate an absence of native title, and the subdivision L, low impact future acts. There aren't that many of those, and generally they're those two that I've said. The bulk of the Future Act procedures, those procedures that require merely notification of native title parties and an opportunity for their comment, sometimes consultation. But it's that essentially procedural fairness element. Notification, opportunity for comment, consultation, sometimes exhorted to take into account the views. But essentially, as I say, it's a manifestation of administrative law procedural fairness. And the key, as I say, I just pulled a few of them, but they're quite common in the Future Acts. The primary production provisions of subdivision G, the management of water and airspace of subdivision H, and the facilities for the public provisions of subdivision K are example of that general area. Then we get to the ones that most people have probably heard of, the right to negotiate provisions. The right to negotiate itself is found in subdivision P, and the various provisions relating to the granting of mining titles and compulsory acquisitions are the main elements of the right to negotiate class. So it's important to bear in mind that the right to negotiate, which is seen as the high watermark in the Native Title Act, is exactly that. It's a right to negotiate. While there's been discussion regarding the legislative clarification of the requirement to negotiate in good faith, and you might remember in that description I had of the Social Justice Commissioner's what was required, he was talking about negotiating good faith, and so this is often comes up. The Greens in their reform bill, Native Title Act Reform Bill 2011, was suggesting clarification of the good faith requirements of the RTN and the Native Title Act. And I think certainly the current attorney, Roxon, announced in June that the government was going to similarly introduce for specification of the good faith requirements in the right to negotiate. But the point I want to make here is the right to negotiate, even in good faith, is just a negotiation. It doesn't alter the fact that good faith negotiations are still negotiations. under the RTN, if the negotiations do not lead to the agreement, to the consent of the Native Title Party, the proponent can have the matter determined by the National Native Title Tribunal. The tribunal, of course, may approve the proposal in spite of the opposition of the Native Title Parties. In short, none of the Future Act procedures of the NTA satisfy the free, prior and informed consent requirements of provisions such as Article 32. Arguably, they might satisfy those in Article 27, but we'll come to those later. The only land rights regime that I'm aware of that would satisfy the Declaration Free, Prior and Conformed requirements are those under the Aboriginal Land Rights Northern Territory Act 1976 of the Commonwealth, the ELRA from the Territory. In those provisions, the traditional owners have a veto on any proposal. But as far as I'm aware, and there might be some others, that's the only piece of legislation that includes that veto. The free, prior and informed consent is essentially a veto. So unless at a domestic level we've got legislation in the nature of ELRA, and we haven't anywhere else as far as I know, that whole Article 32 and everything that comes with it, the free, prior and conformed consent, and I listed the articles that use that formulation, simply aren't satisfied. And I suppose the point I'd emphasise again is the good faith amendments that have been discussed and pursued by people with the best of intentions still get nowhere near it. Good faith is simply negotiating in good faith. There's no requirement for consent. Now, the next topic that seemed to float around in the discussions of the declaration was this notion of cultural revitalisation. And the main discussion under this issue seemed to focus on the Native Title Act requirement for ongoing traditional connection as considered by the High Court in Yorta Yorta. And the concept of cultural revitalisation. Now, that concept appears in two articles that I found, particularly 11 and 13. An Article 11 I put up there, and you see the Indigenous peoples have the right to practice and revitalise their cultural traditions and customs. It includes the right to maintain, protect and develop the past, present and future manifestations. A few matters arise in this context. First, the notion of reversing the onus of proof in relation to the establishment of traditional connection, as contemplated in that Native Title Act Reform Bill of the Greens in 2011 and still subject to some debate, while highly desirable, and I've been quite actively involved in pursuing that amendment, does not address the notion of cultural revitalisation. Doesn't get anywhere close to it. It does make the evidential establishment of an ongoing tradition easier, but it's simply reversing the onus of proof. The requirement for proof is still there. So you still have that requirement for an ongoing traditional connection. The second matter, though, is that the references to cultural revitalisation in Article 11 arguably don't necessarily extend to land rights. To me, just on the read of it, it would appear to contemplate what in an Australian context I would have described as cultural heritage legislation or sacred sites legislation. In Australian legislation of this nature, that is sacred sites or cultural heritage legislation, an ongoing traditional connection isn't really a requirement in most of the ones that I'm familiar with. And why am I saying that? Well, if it's revitalise their cultural traditions and customs, includes the right to maintain, protect and develop past, present and future manifestations of their culture, such as archaeological or historical sites. To me, Article 11 isn't really speaking to a revitalisation of culture giving rise to land rights. Now, there might be some aspect of that, and we'll come to that when we talk about sections 26 and on. Similarly, Article 13 that I mentioned is really about a right to revitalisation of culture in an educational context, not in a land rights culture context. Now, the second last point I wanted to get to was what I've described as implementing Indigenous governance. And I've used the example here of Article 18. Indigenous peoples have the right to participate in decision-making in matters which would affect their rights through representatives chosen by themselves in accordance with their own procedures, and on. Similar notions regarding Indigenous self-governance are contained throughout the Declaration, for example, Articles 4, 19, 20 and 32, to name a few. It would appear to be a self-evident notion in a document such as the Declaration. The issue regarding implementation in the context of land justice, though, goes beyond the notional to the practical. To illustrate this point with just one example, the main vehicle for the management of native title rights and interests subsequent to their determination by the federal court is what's known as the prescribed body corporate, or PBC. A PBC is established under sections 56 or 57 of the Native Title Act and conforms with the requirements of the prescribed body corporate regulations of the Commonwealth. The PBC must be incorporated under the Corporations Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Act, the CATSI Act, and the members of the PBC under the regulations, subject to some recent exceptions, must be native title holders, but not all native title holders need be members of the PBC. The PBC will hold or manage native title rights in relation to the entire determination area. Well, so far so good. Thus far, the PBC would appear to satisfy the requirements of Article 18. And yet there's a frequent, or there are frequent, disputes around this. The disputes generally focus around two main areas. The first is the question of whether the traditional decision-making process adopted by the PBC is the legitimate traditional decision-making processes. And as a for example, if a decision is to be taken by the elders of a particular community, according to the PBC rules, in relation to, say, a Future Act decision, who determines the identity of those elders? If there's not an immediate community consensus about who or who isn't an elder, who's making that decision? What process is used to make the decision about who are the elders? Who decides whether a traditional decision-making process has been used or whether a more routine majority rules decision? What happens if traditional decision-making processes offend the notions of democracy? What happens if the majority of a claim group argues that a traditional decision-maker is just arbitrary and capricious? How do we react to that dispute? The second dispute that you frequently see in PBCs is how is the relevant body politic determined? A determination area will often be decided on the basis of satisfying technical legal requirements, particularly those established essentially subsequent to IORTA. As a PBC will follow the determination area, that is, the PBC is established in relation to that determination area, the body politic will reflect those technical legal requirements. Frequently, subgroups of a PBC polity will assert either independent rights or a primacy of rights in relation to a sub-area within the determination area. These assertions are often refuted by the PBC as a whole, and a dispute ensues, essentially a dispute between the broader whole and a subgroup within it. Often, of course, the body that ultimately has to adjudicate these disputes is the federal court. In fact, often these issues underlie, or at least are a manifestation, of what the ATSI Social Justice Commissioner was referring to in his 2011 report as lateral violence. And I think Mick was actually pointing the finger at the native title system for exacerbating the situation. None of this should be taken as questioning the content of these aspects of the declaration. What it points to, though, is that implementation of the declaration can still be problematic even when there are no direct legal obstacles. And of course what I'm saying there is the PBC should be a sort of model drip institution. It's ticking all those boxes, and yet when it actually comes to the implementation, you'll often find significant dispute. I don't want to overstate that, but frequently you'll find significant disputes in relation to some decisions. I'm mindful of my time and there you go. I'm always bad at keeping the PowerPoints up with the speaking. Article 26, which is probably where I should have started off, of course, because Articles 26 to 28 are the main land justice areas. Today I want to look in some detail at 26, but also the following Articles 27 and 8, both in their own right and as an aid to interpretation of 26. To start with the text of 26, and you see I've got the three paragraphs up there of 26. the first one, Article 26.1, Indigenous peoples have the right to the lands and territories and resources which they have traditionally owned, occupied or otherwise used and acquired. Of course, the emphasis is mine, but I use it to highlight, to a certain extent, the distinction between the terms used in the first and the second paragraphs of the article. The first paragraph of the article talks of the right to lands traditionally owned or otherwise used and acquired. Now, when I was reading that, questions were abounding in my mind. What right exactly are we talking about? Does this right to extend to all lands historically traditionally owned, even if not presently? Does the right stemming from historical ownership extend to lands otherwise acquired? That is there a right in relation to any lands otherwise acquired, even if not presently owned? It's at that point that the terms of Article 26.2 provide some illumination. The second paragraph applies only to lands which are, and if we have it here, that are possessed, occupied and used. Indigenous peoples have the right to own, use and develop control of the resources, territories and resources that they possess by reason of traditional ownership or other traditional occupation or use. So if you look at 26.2 compared to 26.1, 26.2 is essentially talking about lands under current possession. And the wording is introduced to draw a distinction between lands under current possession in 26.2 and the broader formulation in 26.1. The implication is that a distinction has been drawn between paragraphs 1 and 2 between all lands traditionally owned, which are subject to an unspecified right, and the subset of these lands being those currently possessed, occupied or used, which are subject to the specific right to ownership, use and control. And again, I've got it highlighted there somewhere, have the right to own, use, develop and control the lands. Right? So there's a clear distinction between 26.1 and 26.2. The suggestion being that the lands traditionally owned, but which are not currently possessed, occupied or used, are subject to a right different to one of ownership, use and control. Paragraph 3, unfortunately, of Article 26 doesn't advance the matter particularly, referring generally to these lands being given legal protection and recognition. Notably, though, the legal recognition and protection is to have due respect for traditional law. This phrase is used apparently in distinction to the Indigenous self-government formulations used, for example, in Article 18. Right, so it's just a recognition of traditional law. It's not being decided according to traditional law, and that we've discussed earlier, Article 18. However, Article 28 does provide some greater illumination of the matter. Article 28 provides Indigenous peoples have the right to redress by means that can include restitution or, when it's not possible, just, fair and equitable compensation for the lands, territories and resources which they have traditionally owned or otherwise occupied or used, which have been confiscated. And I won't go on to read the rest of it, but it's up there. In the context of the distinction between the broad class of lands referred to in Article 26.1 and the narrower class in Article 26.2, Article 28 provides for clarification of the right that may exist in relation to lands traditionally owned but not currently possessed, occupied or used. It's a right to restitution or, in the alternative, just, fair and equitable compensation, either of alternative land or monetary compensation. Before leaving the declaration to consider the domestic institutions which must implement it, I just have to refer to the terms of Article 27, which provides, and again I won't read out the whole thing, that states shall establish and implement in conjunction with Indigenous peoples concerned a fair, independent, impartial, open, transparent process. Again, this formulation giving due recognition to Indigenous peoples' laws, and the system is to recognise and adjudicate the rights of Indigenous peoples, and as we go on, including those which were traditionally owned or otherwise occupied or used. The two points in particular to note in relation to this provision are, first, the re-emphasis of the temporal distinction between those lands that were traditionally owned and those that are. The second point is, again, the due recognition formulation. The process thus contemplated is not one of Indigenous self-governance, but of a dominant legal system process that gives due recognition to Indigenous law. No doubt it's stating the obvious at this stage to summarise that in combination, Articles 26 to 28 contemplate a fair and independent, but non-Indigenous, process to recognise and adjudicate the right of Indigenous people to own, use, develop and control the lands they currently possess, and to provide restitution or in the alternative compensation for those lands traditionally owned but no longer possessed. Reasonably clearly also, the ambition of the Australian Government in pursuing the inclusion of Article 27, and Article 27 was, as I understand it, largely a manifestation of the diplomatic efforts of the Australian or Commonwealth Government, reasonably clearly the ambition was to raise a plausible argument that the Native Title Act satisfied its obligations, at least with respect to adjudication and compensation. I don't intend here, particularly without having regard to the secondary material such as the prévoir préparatoire, to undertake a detailed analysis of whether the Native Title Act achieves this goal. Only noted my earlier comments regarding future acts and Article 32. I do intend, however, just to briefly in closing, consider more closely the implementation of Article 28. Because even without knowing the full nuance of Articles 26 to 28, there is one thing abundantly clear about the compensation provisions of the Native Title Act, especially for Victorian Native Title practitioner. That is, they only apply to compensation for extinguishment that occurred subsequent to October 1975, which is the commencement of the Racial Discrimination Act. As far as the Native Title Act is concerned, confiscation of Indigenous lands, at least by the states, prior to 1975 was valid and uncompensable. The Declaration, though, includes no such limitation. Thus, in large part, Article 28 remains unimplemented. I say in large part quite deliberately. Recall that the preamble to the Declaration states that it's a standard of achievement to be pursued, and I think Melissa mentioned that in her opening comments. There is one institution of the Australian Government could maintain is pursuing the achievement of the implementation of Article 28, and that's the Indigenous Land Corporation. The ILC was established through amendment to the ATSIC Act in 1995. It was a component of the Commonwealth's response to the Mabo decision. The purpose of the ILC was stated by Prime Minister Keating in his second reading speech to the enabling legislation as being to enable Indigenous people to acquire land and to manage and maintain it in a sustainable way, to provide economic, social and cultural benefits for themselves and for future generations of their peoples. The bill is not directed at anything else on the policy or program agenda. It is for the single purpose of building and sustaining an adequate stock of land in the hands of Indigenous owners currently dispossessed. The purpose of the ILC, established as it was before the drafting of the Declaration, was to fill the pre-RDA hole, that is pre-Racial Discrimination Act hole, in the scheme of the Native Title Act. In my view, this significance of the operations of the ILC to Australia's obligations under the Declaration is perhaps not widely appreciated. So essentially what I'm saying is the ILC was there for a purpose under the scheme of the Native Title Act. That purpose is probably the only institution that Australia has to look at to implement Article 28, but I've yet to see, and I'm no expert in these matters, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but as somebody who works around that area for quite a bit, I've never seen that link between the ILC and Article 28 drawn directly. But as far as I can tell, it's the only institution that gives that plausible argument that Australia is even contemplating compensation for dispossession prior to the Racial Discrimination Act commitment. This lack of appreciation assumes a particular significance in the contemporary policy context, where the ILC is increasingly expected to play a role in the achievement of broader government Indigenous policy objectives relating to economic development, closing the gap, and native title settlements. From my own perspective, I'd maintain that an ILC appreciation of these broader policy objectives can only be advantageous. However, if the ILC is the institution left with the responsibility of providing redress for confiscation of the majority of the Australian landmass that was the subject of Crown grant prior to 1975, then the additional responsibilities that it appears to have now been given of facilitating the resolution and the adjudication of Indigenous land rights that were not subject to the pre-1975 grant, and alleviating Australian Indigenous disadvantage generally, probably require some additional resources. Because what I'm saying there is, if the ILC is one, to fulfil its Article 28 obligations, two, to achieve the economic development to close the gap, and three, to assist in settling native title claims, which it's expected to do now, it probably requires a significant injection of funds. That's quite a bit for a single organisation to do. Conclusion, and I think I've just gone a little bit over time, can we say that the direct declaration's provisions regarding land justice are being implemented? The analysis I've just given you would suggest that Australia may be able to maintain a public plausible deniability in international fora in relation to a number of issues, perhaps more than we might have at first thought. However, in the key areas of future acts and redress for confiscation, the clear conclusion must be simply no. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Matthew. You have a seat, you want to stay standing? We do have a good 10, 15 minutes for comments, dialogue, questions. Hopefully, what we'd like to do is bring native title or Indigenous land issues in general into discussion with the declaration in the way, feeding off the way Matthew's assessed some of the articles of the declaration. Does anyone have any thoughts, any questions? I do see Mark over there. It's not a Dorothy Dixer.
Matthew, with the PBCs, as after the consent has been granted and then they go on to how they maintain it and go on to CATSI, are you hearing any expression from the native title holders as to problems within how PBCs are operating? So my question, I suppose, in a long-winded way is, I know that there are two PBCs in Victoria that itself to give pushback to the way the CATSI is actually enforcing them. Are you hearing that?
To some extent. It's a debate that will often be had within PBCs about to what extent one follows Office of Registrar of Indigenous Corporations, ORIC dictated procedures. And it's a debate in some PBCs. Mind you, many others have moved past that debate and now sort of embrace notions of what's generally called good governance. And good governance often means a fairly standard protocol, the same as any other corporation. In my mind, it's an evolving discussion that any individual Indigenous community needs to have dependent on its circumstances. And when I say dependent on its circumstances, if you've got a PBC that's engaged, for example, in significant property development, it's at quite a high commercial level, it can be very hard to just engage with the white community and a business level using traditional decision-making structures. So often those groups will adopt a fairly structured, standard decision-making process. If you've got a PBC that doesn't have much business, it's easier to use a more consensual-based approach, and you see the shift. It also depends on the individuals concerned. I've long railed against, ever since my work in the Stolen Generations, Indigenous communities being forced to accept notions of traditional that accord with what white societies would like Aboriginal people to be. And this is why even though I work in native title, the whole traditional thing still bothers me significantly. If an Indigenous community wants to adopt a contemporary approach to doing business, that's their choice. And there's nothing wrong with that choice.
Sure, but there's the other side of that too. I mean, there's obviously two sides. We'll talk on the one hand about tradition, but then the same holders who stupidly have to prove their culture to get native title.
Oh, absolutely. And look, the PBC and so the Indigenous corporations are often, it seemed to me for a long time, have essentially had to perform this role of a black box that indigenous decision making goes in one end, and what comes out at the other is a manifestation of that the white legal system can cope with. And there can be a lot of grief in that black box.
Nothing in the words of black box, though. Another question down here at front.
Thank you very much. My name is Hashim Abdul Hamid from Monash Asia Institute. I'm not a legal person, but I'm very interested in regard to the Aboriginal people, their settlements, and so on and so forth, and their claims, of course. History had it for 30,000 years, Australia was occupied by groups of people in River Valley and certain areas, a small area of it. The majority of the land was not occupied. And then all of a sudden, we realized that some of these unoccupied lands were taken over by miners. Gina, like Reinhardt and Palmer and so on and so forth. There's a big quarrel over the land, I can understand, and I can appreciate it. But how do we legislate that this particular area of wealth are not given to the Aboriginal people?
I suppose two immediate responses to that. One, I think, despite all its failings, native title law has been quite good at recognising that indigenous occupation of land, the nature of indigenous occupation of land, can vary depending on the nature of the land itself. And so the occupation of the indigenous people of the Western Desert might be quite different from those of the Gunditjmara around Portland. And I think native title has been quite good at recognising that fact and moving on from that. As to the question which essentially comes to the ownership of minerals, again, the Native Title Act's very clear on it. It certainly, I don't think, would satisfy the requirements of the Declaration, but the clarity in the Native Title Act is Native Title doesn't extend to ownership of minerals, end of story. Minerals are the property of the Crown. If the Crown sells them to Gina Reinhardt, that's the Crown's business. The Future Act provisions in the right to negotiate expressly identified as essentially a legal bonus to native title holders arising from the implementation of the Native Title Act, not a legal attribute of native title.
I did come prepared with a question of my own, so maybe I'll... Oh, no, I have another question in here.
Just jumping between international instruments, that point you raised about conflict between democracy, if you will, and traditional process. Can I just ask if you've got any thoughts on how that fits with the wider sort of notion of self-determination as a human right, particularly when it comes to larger groups and then subgroups with more specific claims, nations and groups, and then how all that gets resolved? And is there any structures put in place or any sort of, anything people can look at and say, this is what we're dealing with. These are the peoples.
It's difficult, isn't it? Seriously, that's almost as good an answer as I can give you. In my practice, it's a very difficult issue. It leads to significant conflict. In a native title context, it's probably easier than the bigger picture that you're asking, because in a native title context, there is, when push comes to shove, I'm a lawyer and I'm working with a piece of legislation. So I've got a client, which is defined for me by the Native Title Act, and there's a decision-making process that legislatively have to be followed through. That can still lead to, some rancor. But at least, as far as my work is concerned, there's a process. In the more general context you're talking about, and in a more general social context, yeah, it's a problem.
One last question. Thank you, assistant.
Thank you. Matthew, you pointed out some of the inadequacies of the Native Title Act. Any comments you'd like to make on the Traditional Owner Land Settlement Act in Victoria as a response by the Victorian government to some of these inadequacies?
Just to give some background to Member Sculthorpe's question there,
The Victorian government, the previous government, passed the Conditional Land Settlement Act, which is an alternative regime for settling native title claims that allows for non-litigious resolution, and the key elements of that what's known as Indigenous Land Use Agreement, which is a specialised form of contract under the Native Title Act. And under that land use agreement, the state will agree to certain benefits to the claimant group, and the claimant group will agree to withdraw or settle their native title claims. I must admit, it was the fact of the existence of that legislation and the opportunities it created that was one of the significant reasons why I gave up the territory after it was close to 25 years up there to come down here, because I think that model provides a much greater opportunity for settlement, and it does that by essentially allowing a comprehensive settlement of claims. A lot of native title, unfortunately, particularly across most of Northern Australia, if you do get through the process, the litigious process, and get a federal court judge to make the determination, it'll be over land that's is or historically has been subject of a pastoral lease, and essentially the native title rights that you're finding exist there, non-exclusive rights to hunt, forage, camp, etc. And they're not really, as I've sort of written elsewhere, not really a basis for economic development, that sort of right. It's a fairly thin right, even though I don't want to underestimate the significance of having the formal determination of native title. The Settlement Act provides an alternative to that. Does it satisfy all the issues I'm raising about the Native Title Act and DRIP? Probably not. The Future Act regimes that are generally in place under the Settlement Act are better, but they're still not, you know, if the standard is the free, prior and informed consent that is sort of throughout the declaration, not even the Settlement Act Future Act regimes has that. At the end of the day, for the higher order Future Act regimes, you're still going to VCAT to make a decision. So it's not that ELRA standard. And the settlement packages are expressed to be settlement for claims under native title, including compensation claims. Well, as I pointed, native title is restricted in its compensation provisions to post-1975 grants. There is no compensation for pre-1975 confiscation of Indigenous lands, apart from the good graces of the IOC.
Thank you very much, Matthew. That's all we've got time for. So please join me in thanking Matthew for his great talk.